Christine Foster. Good morning, Ms. Foster. Can you confirm, please, that your name is Christine Ann Foster and that you're a self-employed planning consultant? And that you prepared a brief of evidence dated 28 July 2023? And that you attended expert witness conferencing for planners that resulted in the production of a joint witness statement dated 14 September 2023? That your opinions expressed were in accordance with the expert witness code of conduct? And that you have the qualifications and experience set out in the brief of evidence I've just mentioned. Now, I understand you have a handful of corrections that you wish to make to your evidence. Could you please take us through those, taking your cues from the court and ensuring that you are very clear as to where they are?
Yes. Sorry, what was that? 19?
118.
Sorry, so paragraph 35 should be 49.
Subject to those corrections, as possible, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief? There is just one matter I'd like to leave the witness on, Your Honour, I thought perhaps a very brief explanation might be worthwhile beforehand. You'll be aware that the joint farming parties in Fonterra have preparing a joint case and have put up some provisions. Ms. Foster, in her professional opinion, takes a different view to the position on life of my client on a number of matters. I thought I would just leave her on those matters for clarity and to ensure that if it's helpful, and then everyone knows where we're at, and that might assist. So to that extent, I've asked the registrar to make available, for you to make available, Schedule C as handed up yesterday.
Yes.
And I wonder if I might give the witness a clean copy,
yes,
if I may approach, and then we're all working on the same Schedule C. Thank you. So, Mr. Foster, you've just heard my exchange with His Honour, so you understand what we're doing here. So I don't require you to explain in detail why you take those positions. If people have questions, they can ask you, but we'll just go through what I understand are four areas where you disagree with my client's position and that of the joint farming parties. If we start with the Whanga Marino wetland rule, which is rule 3.11.4.6, I don't think we need to have it in front of us, but what is your professional opinion on activity status for moderate risk, low and moderate risk dry stock farming within the Whanga Marino wetland catchment?
I proposed in my appendix 2 and my statement of evidence on tuna to Mr. Trevor Coastbridge, and that was a activity, not activity, for a particular band of farming activities in the low risk for seed funds, for the farming wetland catchment, and I haven't heard of the evidence that actually changes my view yet on that. So that position differs from the joint position presented by Federated Farms and the Lands. That's my position.
Thank you. Secondly, the high-risk dairy rule. What is your opinion on the activity status for that rule?
That's the highest community risk, as I see it, in the framework that we have. And I have approached things from the point of view of making least change to decisions version. Constructively, decisions version is progressively more stringent. It's also a central framework with highest risk planning activities being full discretionary. And I haven't seen the reason to change that, so I think it's still highest risk planning activities that are captured by that rule due to the intensity of the activity, then form discretion instead of as a triple pose proposition that others support is restricted discretion.
Can I just check your honour the speed of the witness's answers? Are we keeping up?
I'm keeping up. A little bit fast. All right. I mean, obviously, the purpose of this, as I understand you, you're leading on, is to highlight what the differences are. We'll get back to what people may want to ask about that. There is a full transcript, and so although my training means that I take quite fulsome notes at times, we can come back to the transcript in due course. But I think the witness's pace is generally fine, if possibly a little bit from the speakers.
Now, can I ask you, Mrs. Foster, to look at the document the registrar has handed to you, which is Schedule C, which is the version that was handed up yesterday by my friend Ms. Edwards. And I understand there are provisions in that Schedule C where you take a different view to my client's position. And I understand the first place where there is that different view is in Clause 2C of Schedule C. Would you please explain your view on 2C, or focusing on where you see, where you have a different view to what is set out in front of you?
Just very briefly, and I won't labour the how Schedule C works, but just to refresh our memories, Clause 1 of that states the kinds of stock that are to be excluded. Clause 2 sets out the setback distances that are required in different circumstances. Clause 3 provides an exception for livestock crossing particular circumstances. Clause 4 sets out the time frame, and Clause 5 sets out the rule of origin from which the named livestock are to be excluded. So, and there are in that two exceptions proposed, and the differences of view divide out particular aspects of those exceptions. And the first one is in 2D, where Federated Farmers of Beef in New Zealand have placed intermittent watercourses alongside drains in providing that they will have a minimum 1 metre setback where they are over 2 metres wide, but where they are under 2 metres width, there will be no setback. My opinion is that intermittent water bodies should be treated the same as permanent water bodies. To C, requiring a 3 metre setback in the first instance, not a nil setback if it's the right thing to ask. And that is subject to the next exception, which is the one that's been talked about in relation to flexibility of these in that week, and that's described in 5C, where the joint farming interests have put forward a regime that allows an exception, where a farm certifies that it's impracticable to feed that alternative measures might be relied on through a farm farming plan. And in their scheme of things, the last line on the first page is open to intermittently flowing streams of water. Because I say, yes, this is a consideration which should be open to permanently and intermittently streams.
And Mrs. Foster, those were the two.
Can I just ask you something, stop scratching? And can I just say that that's, we can go to the detail of that later, but it's simply on the basis that if something is impractical in the stream, my logic says that it might be impractical, whether it's contingent or
if it doesn't become practical by the change in the stream itself, it will be something other than the stream.
And those are the two areas where you differ from the position of my client, Fonterra, and Federated Farmers in that schedule. Well, thank you, Mrs. Foster. Please remain where you are for any questions from my friends and the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good morning, Mrs. Foster. Can I take you to the Federated Farms and Beef and Lamb hearing version of Plan Change 1 and Interim Permitted Activity Rule 311.42? This document was filed with the Federated Farmers Legal Submission.
I've got my version of that, Yes,
you're welcome to go to that, because the point I'm going to cover with you can be covered fairly briefly under any version you've got. So tell me when you've got that rule in front of you. Oh, we've got a bound version here in case it's helpful. Great, thank you. Yesterday I asked Dr. Lemire a question about the Federated Farmers and Beef and Lamb edition of the words clauses 6 to 9 in condition 1 of that rule. Do you recall that?
Sorry, let's just go one step back. This is rule
311.42, Your Honour.
311.42, thank you.
Permitted activity rule. It's on page 26 of the version.
All right.
And so the effect of the change that has been inserted here would be to mean, as I read it, that the stock exclusion requirements don't apply, and Schedule C don't apply while someone is relying on the interim permit activity rule. Is that your understanding too?
Yes, it is. That's correct. And clauses 6 to 9, so in Schedule C, 1 to 5 deal with stock exclusion, 6 to 9 fertiliser application, cultivation, and set prospects.
Thank you. And in terms of getting some runs on the board with this plan change, do you support that exclusion there, or is that something that that you would have a reservation about too? It wasn't one of the matters that you covered, but I just wanted to check your view.
No, we've explored that with the reasons that the Federated Farmers New Zealand. And I think what's important is to understand the original framework or purpose of 3.42, which was to allow people to continue until the date they required consents were required under what was then table 3.43, which is now 3.42. So the changes there are really to acknowledge the reality that what's proposed, certainly the Federated Farmers Beef and Lamb New Zealand version of these provisions, is that there would be a period of time, 5-year period of time, until stock exclusion requirements apply, if I can put it that way. So it would be a period of time in which you are required to get up to speed and fully comply. If this clause isn't included, it means those people are immediately non-compliant, which would potentially inundate the council with a lot of applications before the dates intended by Table 3.42, which seems counterproductive. So on that basis, I suggest.
Would it not be the case instead that instead of being immediately non-compliant, those parties would have the same time period as other people in Schedule C to complete the stock exclusion.
That's true. That's a fair observation.
So that's another way of looking at it. So if we can turn to Schedule C now and the version that we were just talking about before. And you took the court through some components where you hold a different view, and I just wanted to touch on one other component there. Clause 4 in the Joint Farming Parties version has the time frame, as you indicated before, for carrying out stock exclusion. And the Joint Farming Parties have suggested changing that to 5 years after the chapter comes off the rather than 2. Now, have you got a copy of the Planning Joint Witness Statement there? Volume 401. Yes, it's fine. And it's on page, in the court's version, it's page 401.0165, where you're discussing Schedule C.
What question is this?
Question, I think it might have been question 17, page 36 of the JWS itself. Now, in the fourth paragraph down, it refers there to clause 4, that's the same clause we're talking about, isn't it? And C, if that's you, along with Mr. Willis. And at that point in time, you've reflected what was in your evidence in chief, which was that you support a 2-year time frame for stock exclusion requirements, provided that non-fencing options are available, essentially to deal with those matters of practicality, that's right. And the second sentence there confirms that you have not changed your opinion expressed in your proposed revisions about that point. And that was on the back of presumably some discussions or in response to evidence from others that sought a longer time frame. And you resisted that at that point and said, no, I'm not comfortable with extending. Provisions, whether by way of Mr. Trebilco's version or the Joint Farming Party's version, include non-fencing methods. Thank you, Mr. Foster.
Slightly
for
the reason that it's just before, slightly differently.
I did find my glasses, but they're not in a very good state. So, yeah, long story, but
he's
fine. He's much better now. So, I do have some questions for you, and just to give you a steer of where I'm heading from the outset. My questions, I have a few questions just on the evidence, and just some questions on policy 2 and policy 4, along the lines of the questions I put to Mr. Trebilco. And then questions, of course, on Schedule C and Schedule D. Unlike His Honour, I don't take very good notes, so I'm going to start with Schedule C, because it's fresh in my mind. So if we can turn to the version that we were just taken through by the council, the Beef and Lamb Fonterra Dairy New Zealand version. So, what's Schedule C? So, I guess the line of questioning I also had for Mr. Gerard was around the version put forward to the court when Fonterra presented, and I just wanted to understand whether you obviously had a hand in preparing that before it was filed.
No, I didn't have a hand in preparing it.
No.
I have given advice to Beef and Lamb New Zealand about different propositions that were under discussion,
right.
And they have shared that with their fellows, who I have been involved in privy to the discussions that resulted,
right.
Which turned out that the version was handed up.
Okay. And so I do note in your evidence that you've done an extensive amount of reading of evidence.
Some of it's been retained.
And I just noted that there wasn't any reference to evidence by the Director General. And I appreciate that when you prepared your evidence, so too were the experts for the Director General, so you wouldn't have had that opportunity. But I wondered, were you involved with the council level hearing in there?
No, I wasn't.
So you didn't see the evidence that was filed for the Director General at that stage?
No.
Okay. You didn't consider having a look for that by any chance in preparing your evidence?
Yes, just as a practice, I tend to read the Section 52 report or propositions, and I find the decisions and the reasons of a hearing to be useful.
Yes.
And understand that it's informed by different parties.
Yes.
But it's the decision
that you focus on. Right. And so you would have seen in that decision parts of the Director General's evidence referred to?
Yes. I'm going to ask you a question.
Right, okay. Alright, so let's have a look at Schedule C. And so maybe just picking up on the view you had, or your evidence in relation to Schedule C in light of the comments as you spoke to your legal counsel. So with relation to Clause 2D, what I understand just from what you've said is that your view is that it should be 3 metres or intermittent, is
that? That intermittent streams should be treated the same as permanent
streams
dropped into Part C.
Part C, right. Okay. So having that 1 metre in average.
That's really an option available.
Right. Okay. And so in your view, removing D and having intermittents included in C,
yes.
That's your evidence.
Right.
Yes, of course, but it's the gist of that. And so with that approach, and look, some similar questions that I put to Mr. Gerard, I'm mindful that the wording in Clause 2C relies heavily on the discretion of the plan supervisor. Do you accept that?
Would you see
that as a discretion that they hold as well? Would you describe it as a discretion?
I think it's a limited discretion in the way of a judgment, yes.
And so, I mean, with that reference to not practicable, have you thought or given any view to how what criteria might be applied to that to help guide the supervisors?
Yes, I've had my own discussions with Dr. Crystal about what that might, the criteria might be when terms of narrowing or losing, constraining what practicability means in those terms, my sense is that sits almost entirely with the regional council, that being capable of setting the line at the right sort of threshold. So we are able to provide guidance, whether that's formal guidance in the plan, separate from the plan, about what practicability means or when practicability means. So I think that it would be a guided exercise of judgment.
And have you turned your mind to what type of guidance that might be? What would that look like? Have you turned your mind to that? I'm hearing you that you think that's less with regional council, but you as a planner, have you thought about the actual criteria?
Well, I had conversations with Dr. Crystal about that, so it could be to do with topography. I don't have a comprehensive list because it's not really my brain is that, but it could be to do with the configuration of the fences available on the farm. It could have to do with any program to change those, for races, circulation of water, etc., and the timing around those. So, but my conversations with Dr. Crystal leave me confident that there could be some practical guidance given, some documented form, also forward training, aware that certifiers, so I was curious about this, and have talked with Dr. Crystal about exactly what training these certifiers get. So I have looked at the modules, the website that they have, so I think the scope for including it in there as well. But I do support there being some guidance and clarification for everyone involved of what impacts the
And so, just hearing that, and I appreciate you're just considering this as I'm asking the questions, but do you think that it should also, given that the reason for the setbacks is to protect water quality, any water quality type criteria be in the mix of all that? Because what I think I'm hearing from you is more around farm systems. I appreciate that, it's a farm. But what about water quality matters, for example? Any factors around, you know, what measures might be in place or put in place or included in the criteria to ensure water quality is restored and protected?
In the version of Chief of Sea, I included in my appendix C, where the scope of exception was provided for, I included the three most important outcomes intended by policy 2, capital B, F, for stock exclusion, because I felt that it was important to put on the same page the reasons why stock being excluded. And having looked at the training modules for farm supervisors, I'm confident that's been covered as well, but for I'm supportive of including that on the same page so it's not lost sight of.
So then they should see some units. Right,
it's
not
there.
Is it?
In a reference, I think, here to policy 2, capital B, but the words, the particular bullet pointed text.
Yes. Right, and you support that being included.
Yes, I suppose. Yes.
So in your version, as foster,
yes.
I think that, I'm not sure if you have the paginated bundle, page 41, is it? Is where Schedule C starts in your version, which I have at 307.0491.
This is middle of the page, Roman 2, A, B, and C.
Prevent or minimise direct deposition of urine and feces, reduce sediment loss, reduce damage to the bank.
Yes, and that's a direct replication of the outcomes intended in policy 2.
Thank you. And I suppose I'll just come back to this level of discretion and similar question I put to Mr. Gerard was around the planning statement.
Mr. Willis.
Sorry, Mr. Willis, sorry. Sorry. With the planning witness statement, there was an agreement reached in there. I could take you to it. Back to question 27. That's kind of the end of the document, page 33. And so in there it sets out from Mr. Trevelco's evidence, Schedule C, and then on the second page there, actually, I go over to the page 35. It refers to our fundamental disagreements with the structure of the rule and uncertainty of the permitted activity. It includes yourself and Mr. Willis and some other planners, including the Director General's planner, that there is concern that the permitted activity rule needs to provide clear requirements and not leave excessive discretion to the farm certifier. And whilst that comment is referring to Schedule C, Clause 1, I do note there is similarity of wording proposed in that version anyway to what's being proposed now by the farming interest in Schedule C to C. And so I would expect that the concern that you had with Clause 1 should also apply to Clause 2.
Yes, and that's why I say I support more specificity about what
the transition means. So is it your evidence that if that criteria for more specificity is put in there around criteria as to what is practical or not, then you no longer have the concerns you've expressed in your expert witness conference?
Yes, I understand. Yes, but I feel it could be that issue could be resolved.
Yes. All right, thank you. And so, are you familiar with the Ashburton Lakes report?
No.
Okay, well, I've got a copy for you for the court and the witness copy. I won't get you to read it all, but I just wanted to take you to the key lesson, because it's a report that it's the Otere Wharekai Ashburton Lakes Lessons Learned Report. And so, bit of an insight, I won't go into too much detail, but it was found in terms of those lakes that despite endeavours to support lake health since 2007, and I'm referring to page 4 for the review, in the second paragraph, that the lakes showed increased evidence of eutrophication. Once a lake becomes highly eutrophic, restoration to a healthier tropic state is difficult and costly. So that was one of the findings, I guess, in relation to this report. But if you go to page 9 of that document, it sets out the summary of core findings. And in bullet point 3, it states, subcritical decisions were devolved to farmers and their advisors. These included the end loss limit calculation, in which the land water regional plan on expecting limit setting methodology was applied to the farmers' input data and the choice of implementation of good management practices and actions to stay within the limit. So they've made that because critical decisions devolved to farmers and their advisors. And then in 5, bullet point 5, good management practices were also used alongside the end loss rule, but we're not able on their own to drive adequate reductions or provide a firm limit. And then the next bullet point, ECAD was reliant on third-party professionals to deliver the farm environment systems and set farm end loss limits, making it vulnerable to industry capture. While measures to address this were taken, vulnerabilities existed. And then the final point I want to make there is the farm environment plan system is overly focused on process rather than environmental outcome. So long as FEPA or B grade unit audits were achieved, intensification of high risk areas near the lakes were not monitored or controlled. So the reason I'm just putting this to you, Ms. Foster, is in light of just those core findings around devolving decisions, do you still hold the view that with the criteria, there's correct criteria in there to guide what's practical and what isn't? In light of this, do you still hold that view?
I think it's the degradation of what's in the bicarbonate system as well. And I think it's tends to allow whether there's anything different about the way the PC1 framework, together with the federal farm planning requirements, whether there's any difference in the rigour between the today's situation here and the arrangements in place that may have led to the result of the Lakes Region situation. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's fair to ask that.
Yes, yes.
And I do wonder with, what's the level of rigour is. One of the features of the now version of Plan Change 1 that I think is superior to the decisions version is the certification system that's available to the Regional Council to use to ensure that there's some rigour and to also suit the local specific concerns they have for each of our local field bodies of a particular priority and to suit their own demands in terms of rigour and addressing them. So, and I'm not sure whether the expression farm captured by farmers and their advisors was in this situation that you may have noted by it, but I'm a naturally optimistic person and I wonder if there was something different.
So I guess I'm taking from your response then is it depends on the circumstances in that region compared to this what the framework in which each of those regions are operating under.
That's right. The degree of rigour.
Yeah. Yes. Right. But certainly some lessons to be learned.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Thank you. And so and I think this is Mr. Willis confirmed that where there's any inconsistency between the regulations, the stock exclusion regulations and the plan for regulations, would it prevail? Is that your understanding?
The certification requirements as specified in the regulations, yes, I think they do prevail. But there is opportunity for, and it's not yet the attention to one provisions have taken, to specify particular requirements to match the types of degradation, the priority and contaminants of concern, and different employees in my category. That's what Plan Change 1 brings to the plan body work, if you like.
Mm.
So that's not, doesn't have to default to the reasonably high level wording in the regulations about identifying particular values, etc., that she gains or may be in the catchment context of values information, etc. But there's also quite clear direction through the policy framework in Plan Change 1 about what it is that matters.
Mm.
Which matters. So that's all.
Thank you. And so, I suppose I need to ask the question, what certainty do you have that with this approach with the farming interest proposal in terms of wording, what certainty do you have as a planner that the objectives of PC1 will be achieved?
I don't have any certainty, but I have confidence. I think certainty is a situation where it's reliant on modelling to a very large degree. I think it's quite it would be a stretch for me to say I'm utterly confident that this can be met. I don't know what's going to happen in the next 10 years, but I have confidence based on the evidence that I've read, the structure of what's proposed, the certification requirement that's been inserted, that those measures will drive change. Also, that what will be measured isn't some artificial number, but it will be actual change on the ground. And I have confidence also that the Council will have a larger information body than they've ever had before, larger than the regions will have, of what's actually happening on farms and a base for attributing successes and failures and learning from that. So that's how I would have.
Can you say that they'll have larger information, would you say?
Yes.
How is that?
Through farm tanks.
And that's on the basis that there's monitoring?
Well, they're required to be registered together to the regional council, but when they moved these past documents, I'm not sure that they were through that. And there was, I think there was work to be done yet, the sector isn't aware of this, forming a relationship between if it may not impact.
So, with the provisions, you don't consider that we've just been going through that it's a backward step from the decision version?
Backward step. Yes, I think it's interesting language. I think that I acknowledge that the regime that I'm proposing the Schedule C has more flexibility than was provided for in the Plan Change 1 framework. But I point to the role that Farm chains will have in that, in ensuring that the particular risks on individual farms, the vulnerabilities of catchment, are addressed by actual measures implemented through farm plans. So, the concern that I have about stepping backwards, as you put it, is moderated by that.
Thank you. And I'm not sure, I know you've done a Section 32 analysis or focus that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's that answer that the relationship between the Schedule C stock exclusion requirements and the in place now stock exclusion regulations is complex. So I've, in my own way, I haven't included it in the evidence, but I've certainly gone through and analysed what prevails, what do PC1 provisions add to that, and certainly add additional strength, they don't weaken those. So I have gone through that exercise of understanding in what situation, for what stock, for what body types, is it different from the decisions version, and am I concerned about that? That's the answer I've had before.
Right, you're not concerned. Thank you. And so, with the Section 32 analysis, and just in relation to the farming interest version of Schedule C, and I've had an opportunity to look at that schedule through the lens of Section 32.
Yes. I'm not for writing it up again, I'm very sure I have an opportunity to do that, but I guess that's behind the thinking of the points of difference that we have.
Sorry, could you explain the points of difference?
Those were just explained by us to Mr. Thompson.
Right, I see.
Walk through the differences.
Right, I see.
With the refinements that I propose, I broadly expect technically that they are more appropriate than the decision version in the most appropriate way. But I haven't gone through that stepwise analysis.
And when you go through that step point analysis, no doubt you take into account to define one of these
steps.
And so in terms of the strategies set out, what strategies would you be focused on, or have you given time to consider that?
Well, the list is not in front of me. I don't need to put it in my mind.
Right. I'll
So
I'll take it, there should be a copy behind you, or just a certain one. Yes.
Could you also point me to the very folder?
I do have a copy, I'll just grab that. Sorry, it is a bit coloured, but it will give you an opportunity to see all the colours and things.
So that's the schedule attached to the information.
Yes. Sorry, just Look, appreciating that you're still thinking about your Section 32 analysis in relation to this latest version, my question was, in terms of the strategies set out in the Te Tere Whānau, which ones would you consider relevant, direct relevance, to be considered in the Section 32 analysis?
Right.
Any in particular?
No, I think they need to be read together, the shoulder in one's mind, as a collective, which is quite challenging to do.
Yeah.
But they're there for a purpose. If there is a end game, and that's the improvement, the restoration. So I think they work together, but I don't think anything is particularly gained by stepping through them, ticking the crossing, but certainly. And I hope that's communicated through my state of evidence that my view is that the legislation, the vision and strategy has a particular unique position within the framework, and I have been one for that.
Yeah. And certainly something to recognise as you do your Section 32 analysis.
Yes.
Thank you.
It's a bit of a trump card.
Thank you. And so, just in terms of, sorry, just going back to Schedule C, just one final question in relation to wetlands. So, on my read of the farming interest version, there's an exclusion of wetlands 50 metres squared or less. And so, with the definition of water bodies that excludes that size wetland, and then with the definition of ephemeral springs and ephemeral water bodies also excluding wetlands, where do you see the smaller wetlands, how do you see those being managed through this wording or in the plan?
Well, so just to be clear, I do support the threshold area at 500 square metres for wetlands, just taking a lead from the Scottish regulations reading. And I went back to the decision to look for reason for the 50 square metres, and the choice of times between nothing and something, and 50% in the absence of any information about driving. But I think wetlands that are small, to the extent they're discernibly different from ephemeral patches, wetland species. I think the requirements of the Federal Farm Plan regulations and the D1 and D2 planting requirements expect that those will be identified. So that's the first thing, is to identify them and to identify what risks are present for them. So my expectation is through a farm plan, the requirements of the policies to identify and protect, and to still be able to degrade if that's the case. To maintain we're not degraded and we degrade to school. That's where they're really given.
So, farm ground plans is your advice as a planner that the smaller wetlands should be managed through that process?
Yes. Alongside the requirements of the stock exclusion regulations, which require that wetlands of any size, if they feature threatened species, stock must be excluded from them, so setback one, but those be excluded, so those are treated something differently. And those over 500 square metres, stock exclusion regulations require exclusion, but no setback, so pension one actually.
And I just noticed, and you might not even answer here, that the schedule did not refer to clauses 6 and 9 in terms of vegetable production and commercial vegetable production. So,
just explain.
So, in the Schedule C, the actual, I'm just looking at your version.
It's just an excerpt.
Right.
I don't think it's intentionally Okay,
so we didn't deal with the
Right, okay.
So just to be clear, the focus of the farming interest was on what's in here.
Stock exclusion.
And no comment on the
through the stock.
Yes.
There was a discussion in the stock exclusion.
Right. Thank you. All right, so if I just go back to your evidence, and I might have already covered a wee bit of it. Sorry, just looking at your paragraph 198 in your evidence. So in 198 you refer to clause C, or schedule C, and clause C seeks to exclude stock from all wetlands, including constructed wetlands. And nothing, noting the interest of the NPSFM. The size threshold is very small and captures potentially isolated wetlands, and you support the larger threshold, as you've confirmed, proposed by Mr. Matheson for Federated Farms. Have you read Dr. Robinson's evidence now?
Yes.
So, in his evidence, and so behind you in the folder 320 volume, in tab 7, you'll find Dr. Robinson's evidence. And if you go to page on paragraph 56, which is on page 15, so in there he talks quite a lot on the critical nutrients focused on the nitrogen and phosphorus. There are nutrients indirectly influence the primary productivity of vascular and non-vascular vegetation, so this is referring to wetlands. They reported excessive nutrient enrichment, increased nitrogen phosphorus. This can result in a loss of plant species, as more aggressive growing weed species become more dominant, as it has been observed at Whangamaringa wetland. And then in 58, referring to Clarkson's, nutrient enrichment can dramatically alter vegetation composition, health and habitat values in wetland, and is arguably second only to hydrological disturbance as a cause of loss of wetland condition in New Zealand. And then, paragraphs 60 and 61 continues in that vein. And so my question to you is that, given your view, your evidence in paragraph 198, your evidence, do you hold firm to that view in light of Dr. Robinson's evidence around only managing those threshold or those size wetlands that Mr. Matheson support?
I think my evidence is, in this respect, answering a different question. And I'm considering Dr. Robinson's evidence and all the other evidence about degradation and risk in a situation context. So it is part of, to my mind, the relevant question and relevant information that needs to be assimilated and considered in Section 32 regulation. So I see it as an important input, but not the only one. So I, as a planner, required to consider Section 32, environmental, social and other costs, and these are what Dr. Robertson is describing, but I can't stop the and I acknowledge it.
Do you acknowledge it anywhere in your evidence, though?
Dr. Robinson's evidence? No, I wasn't producing it.
No, of course. Thank you. And so, just some questions on policies 3 and 4. With policy 2BGP, Roman numeral 1. We've got a copy here. Yes, technically. And again, some similar questions that I put to Mr. Tadalco, just around the critical source years. And so, in that part of the policy, we farm cattle. Pigs are food from rivers, stream drains, in accordance with Schedule C. And then the first part there, ensuring adverse effects of stock on water bodies are minimised, including identification and management of critical areas. Do you have any view on how to identify and manage these areas, given the current rat policy, how that would actually work on the ground?
Oh, I'm probably not the right person.
No, you're not.
So you can ask that question, I think.
So if we go to Schedule D, because my questions on the policies were around the critical source areas, but also to Schedule D1, please. So in Schedule D1, Part 4, Part D, is it? D, yes. And then Clause 4. That's it. So, and again, look if it's best suited for another witness, then to say so. The actions to minimise sediment loss from the critical source areas, what would you see those actions to be? From a planning perspective, we'll just say that.
I would read from Scott Crystal's evidence in that field, and she does list some measures, and I rely on her evidence. So I think there are some, in answer to your question, I think there are actions available to manage. Some of them are management, and some of them are structural, installing septic traps, etc.
And going to D1 part D again, but there, D clause 5. Again, when any land adjacent to Schedule C water bodies is being utilised, the sacrifice paddock, an ungrazed vegetation buffer at least 10 metres from the edge of the water body shall be maintained. So, I guess two questions there. How do you see that working on the ground, and why do you think a 10-metre setback is appropriate there, not in Schedule C?
I would turn around to particularly commitments from this is a standard that's in dispute, I think, between farm experts. The particular activity here is one of the most intensive farming types of activity. So I think that's the distinguishing factor, and this essentially it's not so disputed, that it acknowledges that and requires a particular attention to it. So whereas in Schedule C, the setbacks are for all intensities of farming, apart from if we go back to it.
So this just on that point, if it's all intensities for Schedule C and only one intensity for Schedule D, wouldn't it make sense to have wider setbacks when you're covering different levels of intensity?
We should go to that level of specificity in the plan, but I think that's what the farm plan is supposed to do. It's supposed to identify the risk associated with individual practices in the way that I can't, and I doubt that any consent plan could either. But that is the reason I think for the difference. And in Schedule C, there's a requirement for setback with or exclusion with setback for particularly
So those are my questions for you, Mrs. Foster. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I do have some questions on critical source areas, but I hope they're of a planning nature and that you can address them or give some guidance. By way of background, we spent a lot of time figuring out some standards for fencing, excursion, etc. But probably the elephant in the room is trying to reduce discretion of the certifier regarding critical source areas. Yesterday, Federated Farmers produced a regional council, I'm not quite sure how it should be described, a guide or some indication of what might constitute critical source areas by way of photos. I've consulted widely with the farming community, that is two people, two farmers over lunch yesterday, our view, and I think it would be largely supported by farmers, that the photos are very helpful. Quite frankly, I don't see any other way of trying to nail it. Those photos are what I describe as very obvious critical source areas. So the question really comes down to how does a set of photos distinguish what is and what isn't? And it almost seems to me there is a need for another set of photos saying these are not. Somehow we have to find that line. Just from a planning point of view, can you help me through this conundrum of how do you, in the form of photographs, provide some certainty?
Well, I think they certainly have utility. I've seen it used in other jurisdictions, other regional councils, district councils, have used photographs, for example, to help define to describe and good, clear photographs.
Given the level of concern from all parties in this room, and given that these won't be go through a first schedule process, is there room for stakeholder engagement? Let's not use that word consult, but something less formal, stakeholder engagement in the formation of guidelines for critical source areas.
Yes, you
talk
about going through a Schedule 1 process?
No, definitely not.
Okay, so thank you for clarifying that. Guidance of that which is often best set outside
Yes. Well, I'm thinking why they've been farming community with Doc and Chris and Dan here, certainly showing keen interest.
Yes, and the council has a collaborative relationship with the river here, and I imagine that would then continue as well. So, but I see that's a very positive feature of those relationships are made.
Yeah, so I guess it widens out to more than just guidelines on this subject, the joint witness statement for farm systems called for guidelines on a few other issues, and I think you mentioned another one this morning. So I just wonder whether it would be useful in the implementation methods to actually refer and give some sort of comfort to stakeholders that council will engage with the key stakeholder groups in the development of guidelines for this. So nowhere near a Schedule 1 process, but simply some engagement.
Is there a question?
Yes. Should there be a statement in the implementation methods section of the plan giving comfort to all stakeholders that guidelines will have some sort of engagement process with the people organisations? We've talked about some particularly sensitive areas of the catchment, San Marino, peat lakes, some of the highly erodible land in the Waipara catchment. Do you think the guidelines should have some focused attention to those areas rather than just a one size fits all over the whole area? Meaningful for farm hands, and that's the intention, is it ought to do exactly that. So I think that job will be done by other meeting other requirements. So it's probably that one. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Start by putting a few general propositions to you.
first one being, first of all, it would help if you have volume 319, which is the brown folder, which contains the fish and game evidence. So, firstly, do you agree that planning provisions should, as far as possible, resolve conflicting considerations so as to guide decision making rather than leave decisions to be made on a case by case basis?
Yes, that's right.
And do you agree that if you're bringing in a new regime for farming, that is a little bit of a sea change, if you can call it that, in the Waikato, that you would need to ensure that it's fair and equitable amongst those who are going to be affected?
Fairness and equity aren't explicitly considerations in section 32, which is the driving decision making mechanism. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure it will be a consideration in terms of efficiency and where costs lie, etc., but not as a label itself.
Mm. But it's a key consideration, isn't it, under effectiveness and efficiency,
yes,
and,
yes,
because it relates quite highly to implementations.
Well, the word is most appropriate. There has to be a consideration of alternatives. Fairness and equity might not be put there in those terms in relation to appropriateness and consideration of alternatives. I suspect that a High Court judge might well have words to say, should the Environment Court say that fairness and equity didn't come in through those considerations. And as a planner, would you agree with that?
Yes.
Thank you. Do you generally agree that provisions need to be able to be clearly and consistently interpreted, including for the purposes of enforcement? And do you agree that, with the exception of subpart 2 of the NPSFM, which relates to the National Objectives Framework process steps, that this plan is required to give effect to the NPSFM insofar as the scope of the appeals enable it to? And Objective 2 to the PC1 has been agreed between the parties. Progress is made over the life of this plan towards the restoration and protection of the health and well-being of the Waikato and Waipa River catchments in relation to the four contaminants by the interim target attribute states being met no later than 10 years after the chapter becomes operative. Alright, thank you. Well, bearing that in mind, I'll turn to some more specific questions. Now, you said in answer to Ms. Tumai that there's a difficulty here in that we can't measure the efforts being made on farm and what they'll achieve in water quality terms remains relatively uncertain through this plan change. And I put this to Mr. Trebolko as well, that managing diffuse discharges, the best planning practice is to manage that to a limit of not. Yes, and so this plan is reliant on
farm environment plans, whereas the NPSFN would require management of diffuse discharges to a limit.
Yes, we specify the rules,
and I think we heard yesterday that farm environment plans weren't originally designed for regulation, so we have to adapt farm environment plans into the regulatory context.
That's what's been proposed.
And so I'll take you through a full of a few of these, but in terms of the reliance on the farm environment plans and the rigour, which has also been referred to, of this plan change, Ms. Ma has concerns around policy one, which talks about the timely implementation of FEPs, but is not specific around that. Policy two, which talks about actions within the FEPs being in an appropriate period, which is not particularly specific. And then we have the words as low as practicable for the objective of the farm plans, which is also not that specific. However, we do have, with the high leeches, a objective for going down to moderate or low. So that's perhaps the most specific element of this. If we set aside the minimum standards for one moment, of this regime?
Because it articulates those drought and cases, yes.
So, do you have the joint witness statement there?
Yes.
You can turn to policy, the discussion on policy 1A. Yesterday, a time frame for farm environment plans to be implemented. And you have said there that you don't agree with the 8-year limit because the farm advice on which you rely is that this is not the way for effective farm plans to work. However, there is a lack of clarity about what timely implementation of farm planning actions means and who determines that. Have you had any further thoughts on that?
Yes. I think there is an intention through policy for farm plans. I'm just going with that. To those time frames and then all compliance being monitored against them. some flexibility because of whether it was
We used to have a priority table that prioritised different contaminants in each subcatchment, but that had to be deleted, didn't it, because it wasn't prepared correctly. Yes, and you referred to the freshwater farm regulations, and I think that's regulation 8.3 that says when identifying actions and setting timeframes, the farm operator must consider the significance of the risk to the freshwater or freshwater ecosystems and whether a timeframe for a particular action is required under a specified instrument.
Yes.
And there are only timeframes for a couple of particular actions in the schedules, one of those being the fences.
I actually looked at that, having read this last evidence, because I think in Schedule 15.1, which is associated with permission activities, and I think that in that schedule there's a fence, there's a couple of things, improving races, gates, etc., given 3 years, but everything else is immediate. So I think there is a time frame.
Yes, so I talked about that yesterday with Dr. Crystal, and she said with Schedule D2 it's difficult to specify timeframes because they're goals, and people may go above and beyond with some goals, and if they go above and beyond, it may require significant investment, which may take you beyond the 8 years. So you've agreed that there could be some further specificity around this, because there's going to be a real risk if there's not, isn't there, that we're not going to achieve objective 2, because people could say, for Schedule D2 at least, I want to do that in 15 years.
Well, I think the collective weight of the policies, the intention, framework in which these farm environment plans sit is quite clear. As I get said in answer to Ms. Tumai before, I am personally curious about how that actually shapes down and what focus is given by certifiers to that, to the end game, which is improvement. So I found it refreshing to read in the modules the clear messages being given there, the regulatory purpose, not the original purpose, but the regulatory purpose of freshwater farm plans is freshwater focus. There are other purposes for farm plans. There's an integrated farm plan which deals with greenhouse gases and all sorts of things, but this particular purpose for which they would be crafted to meet the requirements of climate change one, I think the intent is obvious, and it's also on page and requirement. So that's good. I don't think people would forget that that's the report.
Okay, well, you've mentioned this issue about modules, and we've also talked about guidance being placed outside the plan. Now, that relates to my question about whether a good plan resolves conflicts at the stage of the plan-making process, and there are real issues, aren't there, with resolving conflicts and implementation guidance where people in this process haven't had an ability to submit in an official way.
I think we were responding to the challenges of farming or managing farms. It is a brave new world, I would agree. But it's not a biscuit factory. So there's an extent to which there are variabilities in farming that don't exist for other kinds of land uses. And I think one had to put any framework for those has to be realistic about those, that there is not an identical production unit or process, types of farming activity and the kinds of risks they present will be presented in slightly different ways. So it's quite difficult to craft precise kind of point sources, charge parameters about.
Okay, so one of those is time frames, and on the time frames, if we can turn to policy 2, please, and the policy 2D, Roman numeral 2, which talks about what
it
is.
Capital B.
I possibly missed out
yes,
the capital B. Two capital B, D, Roman numeral 2. In determining the appropriate, and this is for the man version, and in determining the appropriate specified period, and this is for actions and farm plans, employed the following matters. Now, all Ms. Ma has thought, and I note that you didn't have time to discuss this in conferencing, is that the first bullet point there, which is the intention to achieve interim target attribute states in Table 3.11.1, within 10 years of PC1 becoming operative, be elevated above the other bullet points, which relate to reasonably practicable, etc., the costs, etc. So don't you think that consideration should be the primary consideration?
In Roman 2?
Yes, in terms of ascertaining what the appropriate specified period is for actions within farm plans.
If you use this first bullet point in my vision.
Yes, but it's one of a number of things that you consider. So Ms. Nara is
what would the structure be?
If you can go to Ms. Nara's evidence. So you can see that there, that it wouldn't be one of the number of considerations, it would be in the front part of the Roman numeral 2, subject to the requirement and objective 2 to achieve the interim target attribute state. Thank you. Now, if we go.
A couple of things. We might take a break now if you're moving on to the new topic. But I just wanted to raise, in relation to that, and perhaps to the benefit of other factors. I mean, as a policy, which is to achieve an objective in terms of Section 32, then that's really the way in which drafting should go.
To achieve. Yes, that would be.
Rather than intent, it should be to give effect or to require or whatever the chosen word.
Yes, I think Ms. Mars put subject to, but those other words, yes, I'm sure she would agree with it.
Well, we'll see what others may have to say, but I mean, if we bring it back to the requirements of Section 32, that language may. Let's take a